Hello and welcome to The Menu, Monaco Radio's food and drink programme. I'm your host, Chiara Rimella. Coming up, we sit down with the duo who founded Freeze Art Fair to find out about their culinary ventures and the intersection between art and food.
When artists leave their studio, they need to be with people because they haven't had much contact. And so the talking goes on, you know, usually over food.
Also on the programme, we discover Finnair's new in-flight menu for the upcoming summer season.
Of course, there are some ingredients like reindeer and nettles included in the menu. And the inspiration comes from the winter season and the seasonal ingredients.
Plus, we learn about the art of truffle hunting in Provence. All that here on the menu on Monaco Radio. If you've ever been to an art fair or an exhibition opening, you will know how integral food and drink are to proceedings when the art market is in full swing. It's not just about clinking glasses of champagne. So much of the meeting, connecting and mooching in this industry takes place around a table. Matthew Slotover and Amanda Sharp may have already made a huge mark in the art industry by founding Freeze Magazine and Freeze Art Fair, but in recent years, they've also indulged the gastronomic side of their creative appetites. Their restaurant Toklas, just off London's Strand, opened in 2021, and unsurprisingly, it quickly became something of an art canteen, and it's not just because of the works on the walls. This pared-back, easygoing space has become a meeting place for everyone who gravitates around the art scene of London and beyond. And with the opening of Collina inside Fort Road Hotel in Margate, that feeling is extending to the creatively inclined seaside town too. But what makes a venue into the perfect art restaurant? Matthew and Amanda join me in the studio to get to the bottom of this question and to explain where their passions for art and food meet. Historically, when you think about where artists have met through the centuries and where they like to meet nowadays, it's frequently at a cafe, at a restaurant. There is a sense of aggregation that happens in these places. Was there a sense of wanting to create a space a bit like this when you were creating your spaces? Was it an intention or did it just happen?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think you have to understand that art is a solitary activity. Most artists work in their studios by themselves. It's not like theatre or film where you're with loads of people and you want to get away from them. When artists leave their studio, they need to be with people because they haven't had much contact. And so the talking goes on, you know, usually over food, for sure. And at art openings, when, you know, everyone works together to make an exhibition, the big celebration is the dinner after the opening. And, you know, we've been to a lot of those in our time, enjoyed a lot of those. But that's when everything, all the work that everyone's done over the months and years, you know, culminates in a nice dinner, which I've noticed doesn't necessarily happen in other art forms. So I think there is an element to that, yeah.
I mean, also drinking. I mean, there's a history yes. of artists quite, congregating in bars. In
quite famously, yes.
And I remember, you know, years ago, talking to an artist friend of mine and talking about Francis Ford Coppola and his kind of outreach into hospitality and the connection to film. And we were talking about the ICA in London as we were growing up in the 80s as feeling like this incredibly exotic, important space because you could go to the bar, anyone could go to the bar, and you just didn't know who would be standing next to you and who you would talk to. And, you know, I met incredible artists as a student in the ICO bar. And, you know, that was a very exciting thing, the idea that you might be able to create a convening space again that was democratic and accessible for people.
Toklas has now been running for a couple of years. Have you found that it has become the convening place that you wanted it to become? You've obviously met and interacted with more artists than we can mention right now. But do you find that is it a place for friends? I have to admit that I actually did go to Toklas during Freeze Week because I was so curious to see who would be at the tables. Yeah. And it's interesting, right? Where is the connection between your friendship group, the artist scene of London, and how much do you think it has become a place where during Freeze Week, you just have to book a table at because you never know who you're going to bump into?
I mean, every day there's someone from the art world or related kind of cultural field in there. Not everyone. And I think maybe when we started, we thought it would be everyone, but it's a big place and it's accessible to lots of people. And there's lots of academics who work nearby. There's lawyers who live nearby. So it's a mixture. But often you'll have like four or five tables of people who know each other, who've worked with each other, who didn't know the other one was going to be there. And that's definitely what we were looking for, is a place where you could bump into interesting people who you hadn't arranged to meet, actually, but you were pleased to see. And there's a few places like that in London. We definitely wanted this to be on that list of places where happenstance would take place.
What about the art in the restaurant? Because that's the other side of the coin, right? Like, there are also plenty of restaurants around the world that have become almost like mini galleries in themselves. You know, you go to Kronenhalle and you're going to find some pretty incredible things on the walls. How do you create that from scratch in a way? Because a lot of these hallowed art restaurants around the world were frequented by people over the course of the decades, and they accumulated these treasures through frequentations. Whilst, you know, when you start from scratch and you want to make an art-leaning restaurant, how do you go about it and who do you get involved?
Well, actually, it was a real dilemma for us, how much art to have on the walls. I mean, one of the, you know, the most favourite art restaurants in London is St John's, that has nothing on the walls at all. And, you know, we've got lots of friends who are artists who, you know, how does it feel if a gallery does a dinner in the restaurant and it's other artists' work on the wall? And so it's sort of almost a big challenge for us to resolve how art would be in the restaurant, whether it's through asking artists to design napkins or getting friends to design the salt and pepper pots or asking an artist to make a work to go on a wall. And I think it's still slightly in development. Both of us, when we went away and really thought about artists we would like to invite to do something, came back with the same person, which was Wolfgang Tillmans. We both love his work. We followed it for decades. We both live with his work at home and love doing so. And he's so clever. You know, we went to him and asked if he might do something, and we thought he might come back with all kinds of different ideas, collages, you know, large-scale installations. But he came back with exactly the right image. I mean, just first conversation, bang, it was perfect. It's a picture of a swimming pool with vegetables around it in the sun. It just makes you think of summer, of relaxing, of being with friends, of having an amazing moment, of eating something delicious. It's even sexy, you know, it's everything you could want to convey in one image for a restaurant. And that sort of has pride of place at the end of the room. And then we wanted to have a different atmosphere in our bar room. So we thought about a restaurant in New York that was called Le Zee that had posters from exhibitions all over its walls, and it changed to another restaurant and the posters had stayed up. And it just seemed like a fantastic idea. So we wrote to about 150 different friends and said, do you have a poster that you think looks great? Yeah, we could love to host it in the restaurant. And so we created a poster wall from that. And so, you know, I hope we will continue to evolve this. There will be more art going on the walls. There will be artists who design menus for us as a next step. So it's in process, really, I would say. You hope that it will just become a patina to the restaurant over time.
How does Frieze fit into all of this? And how do you feel like your relationship with being involved in the art world and the hospitality world has evolved over the years? Are you swaying more towards one child than the other?
Well, I mean, our day-to-day now is the restaurant. In terms of Frieze, we don't run it. We're not in it every day. We don't own it any longer. We're available because we like to help. If we're asked to help, then that's what we do. And it's really exciting to see Frieze continue evolving. The current team are doing a fantastic job with it. Our outlook, whether it was the magazine or the fairs, has always been very global. And that's becoming even more true. I mean, London this year is over 40 countries in the fair represented, which I think maybe it's actually certainly the most countries have ever been represented. You know, I love art. I want to see art every day if I can. I'd love to be able to live with art. I'd love art in the restaurant.
The Frieze office is upstairs in the building, we should say.
So yeah.
That's actually,
so they come down for lunch.
That's how we ended up doing this restaurant, was because we'd moved Frieze into the building, which is a really interesting building. And the owner of the building offered us the space, and we're like, you need a good restaurant here. So that's how it all came about. So there's a close connection. And yeah, they come a lot. They do events there. Galleries, of course, do lots of dinners there. So yeah, it all works together.
So let's talk about your favourite art restaurants around the world? Because obviously you've done your fair bit of travelling for art fairs around the world. What are your go-tos in the cities where you would end up time and time again that meant something to your art connections, but also in general, the restaurants with the best art around the world? You know, if I am an art lover and I do want to find a Kronenhalle equivalent, where do I go?
Well, you talked about Kronenhalle, and you're right. It's a totally different thing. The restaurants with the best art in it from the restaurants that yeah. people congregate in. You know, in Milan, you probably know Latteria in Milan that just closed, unfortunately. But that is a place where art and design people used to go all the time. And that's one of my favorite places in the world. And it's got about 8 tables. The husband's in the kitchen, the wife's up front. You have to share the table sometime. You can't book. Some people have... There's a guy who'd been there for lunch every day for 40 years. You know, it's absolutely fantastic food. He's got lots of weird ideas about cooking in silver and not heating oil. But fantastic restaurant. I mean, Mads, you used to live in New York. Where would you say would be the New York places?
Odeon, just for its history. Again, you know, it's just a brasserie, but you will always bump into someone you haven't seen in 20 years and someone you just saw that morning. And that's great. I mean, Bottino was a great art restaurant in Chelsea when Chelsea started up. It was partners, all the people who funded it, were galleries that had moved from Soho. They used to go to a restaurant the guy Danny owned down in Tribeca when Tribeca was just a wasteland. And when the galleries moved up to Chelsea, they needed a restaurant, so they helped him open a restaurant. But the food is not good in either of those restaurants. Whereas the place that if you went, you would reliably see half a restaurant full of the art world is Omen. Again, not a restaurant would turn up on any top list of food restaurants in New York. And I've taken non-art people there. They hated it. But for me, it's like home. There's no music. It's a Japanese restaurant. The food is... I mean, by London standards, in the old days, you'd say it was exquisite. By New York standards, you would say it was good. It was in Soho, where the galleries came up together. There was Omen and Honmore Ahn, which no longer exists. It's the OG. And you walk in there and there'll be fashion people, music people and art people, and no civilians. And it's, you know, it's a go-to.
But isn't that so interesting? Because the place doesn't need to be particularly good. The food doesn't need to be particularly good. There doesn't need to be art on the walls. So what is it, the magic ingredient that turns a restaurant into the art restaurant? Is it just the proximity to the galleries? What is it?
No, look, it's partly that, but Jeremy King, I think, nailed it in a recent interview in the FT where he talked about it's how it makes you feel. It's the haptics of a space. Art is about truth to materials, right? Art people don't need fussy environments. Mm. They like simplicity, actually. And they like perfection and aesthetics. And Omen, for example, is just a super calm, beautiful environment that is quiet and welcoming. And
it's unpretentious.
Yeah,
I think that's
very
really important.
It's a good point.
I think people think of art as pretentious. And of course, a lot of pretentious people in art. But artists are not, and the real people who engage with art are not, really. Truth materials is a phrase that we use a lot and that we think about a lot. You know, it's a kind of workaday kind of place, basically, but, reasonably good. But it's not fancy. It's not trying to be something it's not. It's just comfortable in its skin. You know, it's just doing its thing. And that seems to attract the kind of art people that we... I mean, the real artists and the real dealers. Yeah. I mean, of course, there's a whole art world outside of that, which are people that we've met and we've engaged with a lot during Freeze, but who might go to other types of places. But that's not us, and it's not what we're looking to do.
Just one final question before we go. Obviously, there's a whole another side to what, Matthew, you do, which is also at Ford Road Hotel. Mm. There's a new restaurant there as well. We could have a whole another hour-long conversation about the relationship between art and hospitality and the sense of sleeping there and feeling like you're surrounded by art in an atmosphere where you actually feel relaxed enough to sleep. But I guess let's just talk about the restaurant and what it means to add it to the hotel and why did you want to bring it to Margate? And is Margate still as important to the art world as it has been historically?
Yeah, I think it's only just starting in Margate, really. It's super exciting what's going on there. I'm also now chairing Turner Contemporary opposite the hotel, which has got a new director, amazing new programme, incredible shows coming up. The next year is going to be amazing there. Tracy Emin, as you know, is from Margate, as everyone knows, and has started a studio complex with free studio space for international artists, with grants for them. They're absolutely amazing artists coming out of there. One of the only towns outside London that's represented at Frieze and Glasgow is Margate with Carl Friedman, and there's three or four new galleries opening up there. It's a great place for artists. It's the sun and the sky and the very inspiring, but there's space and it's cheap and you can get to London. So, you know, it's not Ibiza, as one magazine called it, but it's going to develop a lot in the next 5-10 years.
That was Matthew Slotover and Amanda Sharp. You're listening to The Menu. Next, we head to Finland and take to the skies to meet the man in charge of all things culinary on Finnair's fleet. Catering above the clouds is famously no small feat and is especially a challenge for chefs who want their recipes to shine. But successfully turning mealtime into something quite memorable while you're travelling can change your expectations not only of the airline, but also of the country you're about to visit. It's a big responsibility, and it's important that all menu choices remain grounded in the food scene that they're trying to represent. Monocle's Helsinki correspondent Petri Burtsov met up with development chef Sami Oksava to talk about his food philosophy, the role of Finnish cuisine on board Finnair flights, and how new menus are devised.
In Finnair's kitchen, just a stone's throw from its hub at the Helsinki-Vantaa airport, the airline's development chef, Sami Oksava, is working on his new menu for the summer season. Oksava, who has worked for Finnair in various food-related roles for nearly 3 decades, is now responsible for the Finnish airline's food offering. Finnair's current winter menu is the first one developed under Oksava's leadership and consists of delicacies such as salmon tataki, pike wallenberry with torched pike perch, chanterelle risotto and pumpkin and chestnut stew served with creamy polenta, roasted pumpkin and cranberries. I started off by asking Oksava about the flavors and inspirations behind the current menu.
The menu is modern Nordic, and we are trying to find the tasties and ingredients of the winter season. Flavors are rich and tasty, mature. Of course, there are some ingredients like reindeer and nettles included in the menu. And the inspiration comes from the winter season and the seasonal ingredients. And try to make the best of them and use different methods of cooking and, for example, slow cooking. And it's like we use those root vegetables a lot and meat and fish, but try to find the best savory flavors and sweet flavors and vinegary tastes and so on, and combine all of those. And you must have always some soft in your dish, something to bite, and some crust, and all those try to mix up. And for the summertime, we have lots of fresh vegetables and berries starts to ripen. And in the autumn, a lot of root vegetables, potatoes, and so on. And it's been hundreds of years in Finland. We gather those in the autumn time, and then we collect them and put them in cellars whole winter, and we live with those whole winter. And we salt the fish and meat and dry them. And when it comes back to the springtime, we wait the nature to wake up and harvest summer ingredients again.
As a more than 100 years old heritage airline and Finland's national carrier, Finnish cuisine has always been a key component of Finnair's customer experience. In terms of food philosophy, this means relying on fresh seasonal produce and simple Nordic flavors.
We like to keep it simple. Simple flavors and, of course, clean and fresh ingredients. And we value the Nordic heritage we have and the Finnish specialties. For example, berries. Berries we like, those are really good. And we like to use a lot of umami, for example. Umami is one of the basic tasties. And it's included a lot in, for example, mushrooms and tomatoes. So we like to use those as much as possible.
You said that you want to emphasize the Finnish roots and have and offer modern Nordic and modern Finnish dishes. But some, I mean, if we look at sort of traditional Finnish foods, some of them are quite an acquired taste. I'm talking, you know, like 100% rye bread, for example. You know, it's not, it appeals to Finns and maybe other people from Northern Europe, but maybe if you give it to somebody from Asia or Australia, or you know, then salmiakki, the salty licorice and other Finnish flavors as well. So do you have to take that into account when you're like, hey, let's have Finnish flavors, but let's also try to appeal to keep all the passengers happy? Is it like, do you have to make compromises sometimes?
Oh yeah, yeah, we have to make compromises, and of course for Finnish passengers those are mostly wanted, but for all the other passengers they are very unique. But we try to find like a Karelian pie, for example, is a good which goes for many people, and berries are much liked and so on, but yeah, we have to make compromises.
For Finnair, the in-flight dining experience is about more than just food. Dishes are served using tableware by the iconic Finnish design brand Iittala and textiles by the local fashion brand Marimekko. The airline clearly takes the dining experience seriously, so I wanted to ask Oksava a bit more about how the new menus take shape.
How much testing goes on for these menus? Because, I mean, so many people are going to eat them, and then when you design them here and you know you're like, hey, should we put that one in or should we skip that? I mean, how does that whole process work?
Yes, glad you asked. We have often development weeks where we are planning, of course, the new menus to come. We gather up very much different ingredients, components, and cook a lot for a whole week, make up plenty of dishes, and then we demonstrate to our team it, and they give them opinion, which maybe goes goes on, and maybe some that not. We pick up those and we keep them maybe for further use, if not at the moment. But yes, we do that a lot.
Food is such a key part of the in-flight experience that it is surprising how few airlines actually take this opportunity to promote their national cuisines and dishes. That is not to say that airline food is not good, especially in business or first class, just that it is often a missed opportunity to use some nation branding soft power. Think about that the next time you're enjoying some sautéed reindeer, nettle pesto, and spruce sprout spiced walnut and sour apple sauce on your Finnair flight. For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Petri Burtsov.
Thanks, Petri. This is The Menu on Monocle Radio. Now it's time for the week's top food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Monica Lillis.
South Korea's fruit consumption has fallen by almost 20% in the last 15 years, according to new data from the nation's Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Rural Affairs. The study shows that the per capita fruit consumption of South Koreans fell by 19% to 55 kilograms in 2022 after peaking at 67.9 kilograms in 2007. The fall comes as a result of supply shortages and soaring prices of the foodstuffs. The Premier of Tasmania in Australia promised that if his party was re-elected into office, he would build the world's largest chocolate fountain in the region. In a visit to the Cadbury factory near Hobart, Jeremy Rockliffe announced his plans for a new chocolate experience, which would include the fountain as well as a chocolate emporium and a premium chocolate studio. He further stated that it would rewrite the must-see list for every visitor that comes to Tasmania. And finally, France's first museum dedicated to cheese is set to open this year. Le Musée du Fromage will open its doors in central Paris before the Summer Olympics and hopes to attract up to 30,000 visitors per year. The aim of the space is to revive interest in the traditional French art of cheesemaking. Those are the week's food and drink headlines. Now back to Chiara.
Thanks, Monica. You're listening to The Menu. Caviar, shellfish and foie gras are some of the world's most sought after and expensive foodstuffs, but none are as mythologized and mysterious as truffles, a category of fungus which grows just below ground and is famously sniffed out by well-trained pigs and dogs in the French and Italian countryside. The Fête du Diamant Noir, the Festival of the Black Diamond, held in the Provençal town of Vaison-la-Romaine, is a new festival dedicated to this delicacy. Now in its second year, its aim is to make the ingredient more accessible with talks and cooking demonstrations, and of course, by having the truffles themselves up for sale. Monocle correspondent Michael Booth, a great truffle fan, went along to find out more.
de la truffe de l'association Le Diamant Noir du Vaucluse. Et juste à côté, on vous présente la filière pistache.
So just coming into the exhibition halls here in Vaison-la-Romaine, where there's a truffle event happening, and oh my god, the aroma in here is absolutely incredible. Maybe not everyone would like it, it's kind of funky, it's a bit like rotting forest floor, mushrooms, and something undefinable, a little bit of drains. I actually love it, but it's an expensive habit.
It is indeed an expensive habit, which is why, for me at least, my truffle consumption is limited to about one time a year at New Year's, when I splash out about €100 on a couple of truffles, each about the size of a golf ball. I put them in a plastic freezer bag with a dozen eggs for about 3 days, during which, because eggshells are porous, their aroma actually flavours the eggs. Then I make scrambled eggs for New Year's Day breakfast and grate the truffles over them at the table. Because with truffles, it's all about the aroma. Literally, they have almost no taste, which is why, unlike with mushrooms, you can't dry them and rehydrate them. You lose everything. I had hoped to pick up some bargain fresh truffles to take home with me from the festival, but my hopes were soon dashed.
There's a stall here with raw truffles. They kind of look like gnarly lumps of coal. And they're selling for €950 per kilo.
That's actually the going rate pretty much everywhere for truffles at the moment. Sometimes they go above €1,000 per kilo. In Paris, much more than that. I've seen them up to €2,000 a kilo. And in restaurants, the markup is astronomical, of course. But I had a plan B. Where I live in Denmark, there are apparently some black truffles growing wild, as there are in southern England. But I don't know anyone who's found any. I do, however, own a dog, so perhaps I could get some tips about how I might train her to find truffles.
Let's go and see if I can talk to one of the traders. Can I ask you a question? Did you find these truffles?
Yeah.
Do you use a pig or a dog?
Dog.
A dog. What type of dog? Quelle sorte?
Labrador.
Labrador.
Yeah.
And how long, how many years to train the dog? Pour faire l'éducation.
Pour faire l'éducation, 3 ans.
3 years?
Yeah.
Well, my dog is half Labrador, but she's nearly 12, so perhaps not the optimal candidate for retraining as a truffle hound. Instead, I spent some time looking around the festival. There was a bookstall full of books about truffles. There were people selling oak saplings inoculated with truffle spores. The vendor explained that you plant them, wait 10 years, and truffles will magically grow at their roots. But I didn't really have the patience for that either. So I kind of resigned myself to buying a bottle of truffle oil as a souvenir to take home. But there didn't seem to be any for sale, which seemed a bit odd. Until I had a chat with the organiser of the event, Nicola. A skinny man in his 60s, dressed in a tatty old woolen jumper and woolen beanie hat, who looked like a character from a Marcel Pagnol story, but who, judging by the reverence of the audience at his lecture about truffles, is basically Mr. Truffle in these parts. Before I put my foot in it by asking about truffle oil, he shared with me his golden rules about cooking with truffles.
Nicolas Monnier, I'm a trufficulteur in Provence, Saint-Saturnin-les-Aptes.
And you're organiser of this event.
Yes.
And it's the second year. Why have you started this event here in Vaison-la-Romaine?
Well, to be able to explain to the public what is the characteristic of a really, really good truffle.
And to someone who's never tasted truffle before, how would you describe the experience, the smell, the taste?
Oh, it's a very, very original experience because you have never smelled like that before.
And I understand there are some golden rules when you're cooking with truffles.
Yes, there is two golden rules. The first is what I call impregnation, that the way of use fat to fix the aroma of truffle 2 days before. And the second rule is not cooking too hot truffle.
Above what degree?
60.
If you cook a truffle above 60 degrees, you lose all of the flavour.
Yes, all of the flavour will disappear.
So those fancy dishes in restaurants in Paris I've seen where they have truffle under the skin of a chicken and they roast it, not worth it?
No, it's stupid.
And
Are young French people interested in truffle? Do they like the flavour? Because it's a flavour that sometimes divides people. How are the new generation of French people responding to truffle?
What divide people is because now the truffle is very à la mode, I don't know, what do you say?
Trendy.
Trendy. And most people use artificial aroma. And that artificial aroma divide because it's too strong.
You're talking about truffle oil from the supermarket?
Yes.
In England, we call that middle-class ketchup. But where do you stand on truffle oil? Good or bad?
If it's real oil perfumed with real truffle, fresh truffle, it's marvelous. But if you buy in a supermarket truffle oil, it's awful, abject.
Why?
Because the synthetic aroma is not good.
So it's a complete waste of money?
Yes.
Can you make your own truffle oil?
Yes. You buy a truffle, you wrap the truffle in the oil and you wait one week.
But truffles are very, very expensive. Here they're selling for 950 euro a kilo?
It's not very true, because the capacity of truffle give its perfume to fat is so strong that with 20 gram of truffle you are able to have 250 gram of butter, and the butter become all entirely truffle.
So the trick is to buy a small quantity and be smart about how you use it.
Yes.
So Nicolas recommended infusing butter with a tiny bit of truffle, which is a great tip, but do take care, of course, not to heat it beyond 64 degrees. You can do the same in olive oil or with cheese, any type of fat. Fat is the truffle's friend, basically. What else did I learn at the Fête du Diamant Noir? Prices for winter truffles peak at Christmas and New Year when idiots like me are willing to pay anything for them. But actually, the best truffles are to be had later in the season, which continues well into March, and the prices get cheaper then too. So, buy a tiny truffle, buy it late in the season, and stick it in some melted butter for a bit, and there you have it. Truffles are actually as cheap as chips. For Monocle in Vaison-la-Romaine, I'm Michael Booth.
Michael Booth there with that report. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday in San Francisco. Also, don't forget to tune into our spin-off show Food Neighborhoods for a tour of some of the world's tastiest destinations. I am Chiara Rimella. This program was produced by Monica Lillis, and our sound engineers were Mariella Bevan and Lily Austin. Thanks for listening, and until next week.